We're talking about substance abuse recovery on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Advocates will gather at the state capitol tomorrow for Recovery Alignment Day. The event will highlight the need to help people recover from substance disorders. Wisconsin is the worst state in the country for excessive drinking, with about 24% of adults reportedly drinking to excess. And $52 is spent per person in our state on public health funding, which puts us 47th in this category, and that's the most recent health rankings from the United Health Foundation. Did you suffer from a substance use problem, sought help, and then relapsed? Tell us your story at 800-642-1234. Jesse Heffernan is a recovery coach and consultant with Helios Addiction Recovery Services. That's an Appleton-based organization that helps people recover from substance abuse, and he helped organize this inaugural Recovery Alignment Day. Jesse, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
So this is the first Recovery Alignment Day. What kind of recovery are you and the event organizers really focused on here?
Well, the focus of the day is to look at how long-term substance use disorder recovery needs to be focused on. And amongst several different advocacy organizations and different movements, too, there's always this this conversation about, like, how do we get ourselves to the table so that policymakers and change makers and even leaders in our community, you know, can hear our stories. There's, you know, a lot of times we say, those closest to the problem are closest to the solution. And so, you know, this alignment day is saying, well, what if we had our own table and we invited those people to that table so they could sit down with us and hear us during our day? And several organizations have done these types of things at the Capitol, but, you know, we're really focusing on, you know, what happens after a treatment episode, what happens for the long-term portion of someone's life that they need to be supported in their recovery and not experience, as you said, a relapse or something like that. Or if they do, how do we make sure we have the services, the supports, and the community ready to bring them back in and treat them with compassion and dignity after having what I would say is more of a reoccurrence of symptoms than anything else?
Jesse, what is the scope of the problem here when it comes to people relapsing back into substance use disorders? Is it a support system that's not there? Is it something else?
You know, there's a lot of different research, and it varies sometimes even substance to substance. We know with folks that struggle with opioid use disorders specifically, like a lot of times, you know, they will exit a treatment episode or they're not even able to find a detox or treatment to necessarily look at those things specifically. But when they do, they have what's called like a less amount of social capital leaving those places. And so less connection to family, community, job services, things like that. And so a lot of times their reoccurrence rates are higher than that of those struggling with other substances. So again, it really varies, and it is about, yeah, the lack of community connection. So I get to travel the state and sometimes the region frequently, and a lot of times I'll open up in small meetings and ask, like, so I'm a person in recovery, I'm hanging out in your town, where do I go to hang out with other people in recovery, right? And a lot of times the room is silent. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe there's some different fellowship meetings. But, you know, a lot of times there's folks that don't even want to attend those every single night. So where do I go and hang out? And if so much of our energy is about getting people to move through a treatment episode into long-term recovery, we need to really focus our energy and our dollars into that long-term portion of this.
We're talking with Jesse Heffernan. He's a recovery coach and consultant with Helios Addiction Recovery Services. And we're looking at the inaugural Recovery Alignment Day that is slated for tomorrow at the state capitol. Did you suffer from a substance use problem, got treatment, and then relapsed because you didn't have the support you needed? You can join in with your story at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Cameron joining us from Door County. Hi, Cameron. What are you hearing here?
Hi. I'm just concerned because I live in one of the, I feel, more rich areas of Wisconsin, and there's there's no help for people out here. Like, I did have an opiate problem. I'm clean and sober now for about a year and a half. It's just concerning because my friends are still hooked and I don't know where to point them, you know?
Cameron, thank you for the call. Jesse, what does this problem look like across Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a large variance of what access people have to different treatment options and recovery support options. And a lot of times in our rural communities, you know, sometimes the closest place is 2 hours away. And so, you know, in the last few years, you know, I've experienced where people go into emergency rooms and they're not able to get full help. Opioid withdrawal is not considered life-threatening. So a lot of times they'll spend a few hours there and then leave with some medications that help with the withdrawals and a list of resources, you know, and there is another program through an organization called Wisconsin Voices for Recovery. They receive funding through the state to be in emergency rooms to help people navigate systems from that hospital episode to hopefully recovery or treatment episodes. But, you know, as a state, you know, we're looking at how do we create these different models so that folks, no matter where they are, can have access to, you know, opioid or alcohol or other substance use disorder help. But, you know, we don't have the detox beds yet. We don't have the facilities yet. We haven't been able to meet that need yet.
So if Cameron and Door County can't find these resources close to home, what does it look like for people who are on this path to recovery?
In my experience with some folks that I've known in the recovery world, a lot of times for opioid dependent users, they're forced to find the ways and means to detox and kick on their own at home. There's regimens they find online, or they may get connected to a methadone clinic or other form of medicated assisted treatment. And so, like, there's a lot of different pathways that folks are taking to find a way to recovery. But again, it's so varied location to location and place to place. And there's probably, you know, 100,000 different stories of what people have experienced. But unfortunately, a lot of times those stories start with they weren't able to access or find the help right away.
And advocates say that continuous recovery support can lower relapse rates and reduce the costs for higher level of care. What does continuous recovery look like?
Right. So what we're coming to the table with is saying that when we provide opportunities for people to connect to the recovery community, and so that's coaching, employment services, housing services, when you look at a person's whole being, so not just their pathology or their diagnosis of being someone with substance use disorder, when we look at all of it, the quality of life, and we provide opportunities to enhance all those areas of life, yeah, there's a lot less reoccurrence of symptoms or relapse that happens. So when you have less reoccurrence and relapse, you have less folks, you know, recidivizing, going to jail or going into healthcare systems, seeking help. So overall, and really, like, I know a lot of times folks, you know, policymakers and everyone wants to get caught up in these same things with the data and the money and all that stuff. And for me, like, this whole Recovery Alignment Day and this whole push is just about, like, let's treat people with compassion and dignity.
We're talking about substance abuse in Wisconsin and the recovery-focused agenda as part of Recovery Alignment Day at the state capitol tomorrow. Jesse Heffernan is our guide. He is a recovery coach with Helios Addiction Recovery Services. And you can be part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. We'll be back to this in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about recovery from substance abuse in Wisconsin. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at the state capitol, dozens of people will come together to discuss substance use recovery priorities. According to the CDC study from last year, one-fourth of Wisconsinites binge drink at least once a month. Do you suffer from a substance abuse problem? Have you worked through treatment and relapsed? What do you think lawmakers can do to improve the path toward long-term recovery? We're at 800-642-1234. Email your thoughts to ideas@wpr.org. Jesse Heffernan stays with us. He's a recovery coach with Helios Addiction Recovery Services, and he helped organize Recovery Alignment Day at the Capitol. Let's go back to the phones now with Jim joining us from Watertown. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Okay. I've been on the roller coaster of recovery since I was around 12 years old. Been in and out of programs and treatment facilities, and I needed that to learn that, to admit to myself that I was an addict, that I am an addict. But the biggest thing I'm finding since I've gotten a better purchase on the ledge of being sober, because like I said, once an addict, always an addict, is I learned that I'm actually a piece of the bigger picture of life, and that I can play a positive role by doing what most people do normally, go out, get the job, or go out and help other people, whatever is your thing. But I didn't find that in the programs. It took getting beyond the program a little bit, getting
to see the bigger picture. Jesse, yeah. I'm going to stop you there. Jim, Jesse, what do you hear there from Jim's newfound perspective after years and years of addiction since the age of 12?
You know, so first off, thanks to Jim and both and to Carmen as well for calling in and sharing that. I think it's a huge step for folks in recovery to come out and talk. You know, a lot of times it's viewed like Fight Club. You don't talk about it. It doesn't exist, so on and so forth. But so for folks to come out, so thank you so much for that. Jim, I think, really demonstrates that there's multiple pathways, that sometimes folks need to have multiple episodes within treatment and find different fellowships to find their own in recovery. And that's really what this is about. You know, like, recovery isn't about one substance. For me, recovery is about returning back to dignity and worth and who we are as people, and discovering our talents and potential and passion. But it takes different forms for different people. And unfortunately, not everyone has that same opportunity that, you know, the three of us that have been on the radio so far this morning have had. So I just hear that, you know, he found his potential and he found the supports in his community and in his life to be able to step into all these different things. And like you said, see the bigger picture. And that was really great.
Let's go to Mike now, joining us from Jefferson County. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I am an opiate addict. I've been clean now for 9 years. And I certainly appreciate and grateful for the chance that I had at a recovery facility and support. But there were a lot of addicts there who weren't ready. And I guess the point I wanted to get across or raise was, it seems to me there were a lot of people who, frankly, it just wasn't going to work. So that access to a recovery support is no guarantee. And I think it's important to emphasize that to lawmakers, or they might say, well, gee, we gave you the money. You had this person one time and they failed. Thanks.
Mike, thanks for the call. Jesse, what is that? Do you see that view when you talk to lawmakers?
You know, I see it vary from kind of lawmaker to lawmaker. We've had some folks within Wisconsin, specifically Representative Nygren, who's helped pass a number of bills that, you know, around the HOPE agenda, right? And I think it's really been through his personal story and his family story that lawmakers have really started to see what can happen potentially, and that sometimes people do need multiple opportunities to go through treatment. And I think they're starting to make some inroads in looking at that and having a more compassionate viewpoint around it. And when we view it as the medical condition and disease that it is, we understand that sometimes people do need that differently. And maybe it's not so much a rock bottom as it is a launching pad for opportunities. And so what if we just continuously help these people and give them opportunities and treatment and recovery support services?
Well, on the list of legislative priorities for this day, you want to see lawmakers commit $9 million annually for 5 years to fund 25 recovery community centers. Where would these centers be and how would they operate?
No, so that that's like the one that gets like the most attention, like $9 million. What are you going to do with that? And we look at like, what's the return on investment for that? And so what we would like to see are recovery community centers that host all types of meetings, host all types of support services, coaches, all types of different things, so that we have these hubs in the community where people can go and hang out. What we would like to do is set up a group of people that are in recovery and people that are impacted by substance use, send out requests for grant applications, and then see what our communities start coming in with. And we know, like, our state receives several million dollars in funding from the state targeted response, from the CARA funding and from the Cures 21 funding that the federal government allotted. And I'd also like to say thank you to Senator Tammy Baldwin, who fought for an additional $6.25 million for that money to come into our state. But we see this as like, let's focus on these community supports and let's see the return on investment from those when we actually connect people with long-term support services.
Let's bring in Cheryl now, joining us from Mountain. Good morning, Cheryl.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say that my daughter is in recovery right now, and she has been since August, and she's in a long-term recovery. She first had 60 days approval through Outagamie County, has been amazing, and then they gave her housing. I mean, and helped her get a job. She has requirements. She has to go in and check in every day to the center. She has to get UA. She has to be clean. I just feel that this is what we need more, is this long-term support, because just a 30-day rehab or something, those people have a really hard time making it.
Cheryl, thank you for calling in with your story. Jesse, do you see there that there is a continuum of care that Cheryl's daughter has found?
And that's incredible. And for those folks that are able to find that and get that structure and get that stability, I say, yeah, let's use those stories and those examples to make our case for that to be able to happen across the entire state. That's great.
So how can people get involved in Recovery Alignment Day?
Well, we're really hoping that they can show up to the Capitol tomorrow in Madison. We're going to start off. There's going to be several recovery and treatment organizations with tables and booths in the rotunda starting about 8:30, 9 o'clock. We're going to meet up in room 425 Southwest. We're going to have some speakers from people across the state, family members, people in recovery, coaches. We're inviting several legislators and lawmakers to stop by to see what's going on. Again, like, it's about us having a table and a presence there. And then at noon, if folks really want to come by for something at noon, in the rotunda, we're going to have a First Nations drummer open up with a ceremony and prayer. And then we have Senator Bewley, the Lieutenant Governor, reading the proclamation for Recovery Alignment Day. The Attorney General is going to be coming in. Representative Plumer is going to be coming in. So it's just a great day. And then we're inviting everyone to go and talk to their legislators. And we know that it oftentimes it may not be the easiest thing to call your legislators. But what's great is that you can just go to their door, and we're going to have handouts for people that have our legislative priorities and have tips and pointers on how to talk to these folks and say, like, this is important to me, to be able to come in like everyone did on the radio today and say, here's my story. And here's what I think our community needs. Here's some suggestions.
Jesse, would you mind if I ask you to share your story about your path to recovery?
No, I'm totally open for that. I was in the midst of substance use disorder for primarily in my teen years. And, you know, a lot of times folks ask, like, well, what was your drug of choice? And for me, it was more like, well, it was a buffet. So whatever was available at the time. And what I learned about myself was that my substance use was more about masking pain and trauma and woundedness from earlier on in life. And really, you know, when I think of what my the connection was to other substances, it was really through other people. You know, so my gateways weren't necessarily pot or alcohol, my gateways were people I was connecting with. And I constantly was looking for that connection to other people and found a lot of other people that were just as hurt or wounded as I was. And so there were several years of that. And eventually it got to this point where it was just ostracizing myself from my community, from my family, from purpose, from passion, from anything. And to the point where I wanted to self-destruct. And I had actually a criminal intervention where I was going through a number of court cases and found myself in jail and then a state-run treatment facility where I spent 9 months. I'm sorry, 5 months, and then back to Appleton for another treatment episode, and then being in sober living housing for almost a year and a half.
And we have to pause right there, Jesse. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jesse Heffernan, a recovery coach with Helios Addiction Recovery Services. He's helped organize the inaugural Recovery Alignment Day set for tomorrow at the Capitol. This is the Ideas Network.
When sociologist Julie Keller did her field work in Wisconsin chronicling the stories of migrant workers on dairy farms, the workers she interviewed here came from 14 different farms. Most of the interviews she conducted with workers took place in their homes where they could safely be away from their bosses. The interviews with workers lasted between 30 minutes and 2 hours and conducted nearly all in Spanish. We're talking with sociologist Julie Keller here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And her new book looks at the labor force on dairy farms here in Wisconsin. It's called Milking in the Shadows. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer who relies on migrant workers to remain viable? Tell us why. What's something you wish people appreciated or understood about the migrant workers you employ? 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Julie, did you find that farmers felt conflicted at all about encouraging migrants to cross over the border, go through those dangerous areas to get to their farms to work these jobs?
I really did. I interviewed 8 farmers in addition to the 60 immigrant workers I interviewed. I did find that farmers did express a deep sense of discomfort with the fact that that they have these workers that they're very happy with. On the other hand, look at all of the danger that these workers are exposed to, that these workers are taking on, this burden that they're taking on for the farm and for their own livelihood to get across the border unauthorized. So some farmers did describe that deep sense of discomfort and a kind of, you know, not knowing what to do with that. You know, day in, day out, the cows have to be milked. So, you know, there isn't a whole lot of time for rumination, you know, no pun intended.
Let's go to Jennifer now, joining us from La Crosse. Jennifer, hi.
Good morning. I just have a comment. I am a teacher, a former teacher of both English to Spanish speakers and Spanish to English speakers. And a previous caller had called about how so many people don't learn Spanish or English when they come here. As a teacher, I know how it's a struggle to learn a second language, and oftentimes the immigrant workers are coming with a limited education, and the grammatical structures of the English language are very complicated, so it's hard to make the equivalence and to learn a second language. Also, my students who have tried to learn Spanish oftentimes struggle with that, or even my classmates from high school would say, yeah, I may have studied Spanish for 5 or 6 years, but I don't remember it anymore. So I just wanted to point out that it's very challenging to learn a second language. And then secondly, that if you think about our own, my European ancestors, the first generation often struggled with the language, but it was the second generation that would come and learn English.
Jennifer, thank you so much for those thoughts. Julie, what about that second generation? These workers are having children, and they're growing up in our schools.
Absolutely. So some of the workers in my study did have children in Wisconsin. who were born there. They're American citizens, birthright citizenship, and they're bilingual. They're absolutely fluent in both English and Spanish. And I also want to mention that the workers I interviewed are indigenous. So the villages where they come from are indigenous villages. They come from a rich culture, indigenous culture in Veracruz, in these places. And so not only are they learning English, not only are they Spanish speakers trying to learn English, they also have this indigenous language that they have that is part of them, that is really their first language.
How has life in Veracruz changed since villagers began working on farms here and sending money back?
Sure. So a really fascinating moment happened in the field when I was in one of these villages, and I was with one of the workers who had come back to her village, and she had spent 4 years in Wisconsin milking cows, and we were standing in her sister's house, looking out the window at a hillside covered with houses. And she said, "Julie, look at all of those houses that are made with concrete. Look at those houses. Those are all houses that were built by people who went to Wisconsin and milked cows." So it was really profound to see that kind of change, right? Previously, people were using just wood to build their houses, and now you're seeing different kinds of materials being used, more durable materials, and also lots of different businesses popping up because people are using the money that they come back with to invest in these kinds of clothing businesses, auto businesses, and really trying to make a life for themselves.
One of the workers you talked to, Alonso, felt isolation living in Wisconsin because it's hard for him to get around. How about mobility and a driver's license and being able to get off the farm?
Absolutely. This was a really tough issue that workers really struggled with. And so in Wisconsin, you have to show proof of legal residence in order to obtain a driver's license. This law started to become implemented in 2007. So previously, immigrants could have access to licenses, but since 2007, they have not been able to do so, and this has been very difficult because if they have a vehicle and if they're driving around, they are at risk of being pulled over, ticketed, possibly sent to jail, and then that kind of starts the process for the possibility of a deportation down the road.
And certainly any type of violation would go on the record, and trying to perhaps get a visa in the future, that whatever is on the record could perhaps, impede them from getting that visa.
Sure. There are a number of different risks that that workers associated with driving, with being on the roads, to such an extent that it wasn't unheard of for workers to ask me for a ride to different places, either because they had a car and didn't quite feel comfortable driving it, or they just didn't have a vehicle and they needed to go to a clinic, they needed to go to a doctor's appointment, to get groceries, to just lead their lives in a rural space, which, as many people know, really does require a car.
Let's go to Joe now, joining us from Sauk County. Joe, good morning. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I want to dispel some of the negative attitudes here, and I'm coming at it as a person who was frankly displaced from a dairy farm. And I'm talking about the era back in the 90s when the trend was just getting started. Some of my observations are, from a farmer's point of view also, for 30 years now, it's been get big or get out, and we're seeing it makes me ill to go to the grocery store and see $2 a gallon milk. Those are 1980s prices. Another point is that any person working on a dairy farm now is in the future going to be subject to continuing automation, and so I would encourage folks to look at Canadian opportunities, because I think the milk market in there in the future is going to be much more stable. those are just the comments I wanted to observe. Thanks.
Joe, thanks for bringing those to the table. So depressed milk prices there is one thing, and automation another thing that could really impact the workers.
Sure. So one of the workers I spoke with recently, the first question he had for me was, Julie, do you drink milk? And I said, yes, I do drink milk. And he said, well, you need to be drinking more. Right? Mm-hmm. We need to have something to do with this oversupply of milk. And so workers are totally aware of this dairy crisis that is profoundly affecting farmers right now, affecting these operations, affecting ways of life, affecting cultures, affecting communities. They're absolutely aware of that. And this worker that I spoke with said, you know, we want to convey all of the concerns that we have as workers, but we also want to tell the world that dairy farmers are hurting too, and we have to have some kind of solution to help both groups.
Did you get a sense that since the Trump administration has really cracked down on the border and the focus is on the border wall, with people in Veracruz, are they planning to return to Wisconsin at all?
So I had, with the handful that I followed up with in 2017, I did have most of that handful telling me I do intend to try to cross the border again to get back to Wisconsin, you know, with a couple telling me if I can't, then maybe I'll look to Canada. But so far that orientation northward, that orientation toward milking cows, toward, you know, earning wages that they could send back to their family, that they could make something of themselves, as they put it. That sort of yearning and that sort of urge does not seem to have disappeared. It's complicated. It's become more complicated with increasing focus on border security, but I didn't find that it's disappeared.
As we wrap up here in the few seconds we have left, where does your research go from here?
So it's a good question. You know, so my book, Milking in the Shadows, just came out this month, and it's really the culmination of many years of work. There are an amazing group of scholars, of activists, organizers, lawyers who are doing similar work as I am, trying to bring to light the concerns of immigrant dairy workers across the nation. And so I am lucky enough to be forming alliances with these people, working with them, asking them, what can I do to help, and really coming together to publicize this issue that's so important, not just for Wisconsin, but really for the whole nation.
Julie Keller, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Julie Keller is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Rhode Island in Kingston. Her book is Milking in the Shadows, Migrants and Mobility in America's Dairyland. Coming up, we talk about a Wisconsin-made film that's all over the festival circuit that looks at dairy workers. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In 2017, the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, they co-produced a 21-minute film about immigrant labor on dairy farms. Los Lecheros looks at the growing reliance of our state's dairy industry on undocumented workers. And in the film, we hear from John Rosenau. He owns Rosenholm Dairy. His great-great-grandparents were homesteaders in the mid-1800s. The operation went from 50 head of cattle in John's youth to milking 550 cows today. And when that dairy grew, he had to get help from an immigrant labor force.
If ICE came in here and checked my employees and found that they were undocumented, and those 10 people left, my next option, of course, is to try to find a market for my cows and sell out. And I wouldn't be able to farm anymore. Just about kill me.
Dee Hall is managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Her organization co-produced this short documentary, Los Lecheros, which is making the rounds at film festivals. Dee, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks a lot for having me this morning.
really profound audio there from this film, and you went into this particular dairy farm and others to really get the stories of these workers. So what did you take away from that experience? What did they tell you?
So this is the second time that the Investigative Center has looked at the issue of immigrants in the dairy industry. The first time was in 2009, based in part on the research by the University of Wisconsin-Madison, that there were 40% of dairy workers were actually immigrants, which really shocked me back then in 2009. We decided to come back at it again because of the such concern over immigration and in immigration enforcement. And what we found in 2017 was that, that there are no good statistics right now for Wisconsin dairy farms, but we found that there are many, it's almost certainly grown. And in the farms that we had visited, probably 3/4 of the workers on the large dairy farms are in fact immigrants. And so we found that farmers had for about 20 years been relying on very heavily on immigrant workers, and that workers were considered to be more reliable. Well, actually just available. Many of the farmers we talked to said that they simply could not find any U.S.-born workers who were willing to do the jobs on the farms.
Willing to do the jobs on the farms. This is a very physical labor, not a day off type labor. And, you're paid slightly above minimum wage. Of course, then now we have really low milk prices, and that could impact wages.
Right. So farmers are concerned about that, and that is creating a crisis in the dairy industry. But they have been concerned for a long, long time about labor supply. That's been a critical problem. And we talked to both farmers and immigrant workers who'd been on farms for 15, 16 years, and they said in that time, not one U.S.-born person had answered an ad to come milk cows. It's just not a job that most people who have options will choose, and that includes family farmers. There are young people who grow up on dairy farms who decide, this is just too hard. I don't want to do it anymore, and that's why many farmers have to turn to immigrant labor.
John Rosenau, you talk with in your film, he's very transparent about it. If he didn't have his 10 undocumented workers, he wouldn't be able to farm. He wouldn't be able to milk his cows.
Yeah, we heard that from several farmers, and we heard that, and the workers understand that as well. They do understand that they are crucial to the operation of these farms, and as a result, in the last couple of years, we found that some of the wages are going up. Of course, there's a pinch now because of the low milk prices, but that, everybody sort of understands what's going on, but we have an immigration system that forces these folks to go around the law, despite what, they would like to go through the front door, just like H-2B visa holders who are agricultural workers. They would love to be in that position and also to be able to return home legally and safely. That's a big concern of a lot of the farmers as well. They understand how isolating and how terrible it can be for these folks to be separated from their own families for years, in fact, even decades.
Talking with Dee Hall, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, which put out a documentary exploring the rising tensions over undocumented dairy workers after the election of President Trump. Los Lecheros ends with this worker who goes back to Mexico, and you see them driving back, that they have everything, that all of the possessions in the truck, and the kids and the wife will be flying back, but there they go off into the distance, and you're thinking, well, so what is there once they cross the border, and if they're able to cross back?
Right. And that's always the concern, is not so much crossing back and going to Mexico to see their family, but being able to return to the United States. That is the wild card. That's the part that some workers are not willing to risk it, because it is a dangerous trip. It's an expensive trip. And there's no guarantee that they'll actually be able to make it to come back to their jobs. And so it's very poignant. Yeah, we did find actually in the course of other reporting, other workers who plan to return, in part because of the negative attitudes that they're encountering here in the United States towards immigrants.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Owen joining us from Wyawega. Hi, Owen.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, so I am a dairy farm employee. I work hand in hand with 8 other employees that are immigrant labor that came over here from Veracruz and Tabasco, Mexico. Do you understand that milk prices are so low because we have an oversupply of milk right now?
So, Owen, I want you just to flesh out your point. We have been talking about very low milk prices. What is your experience working with your coworkers on a dairy farm?
I'm 40 years old, and I've been farming since I was a kid. I grew up in Vermont. Small dairy farmers went out about 25 or 30 years ago, got replaced with larger and larger farms that used immigrant labor to fuel their cow milking and herd health responsibilities, which is 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I also participate in those parts, portions of the business. The owners of these farms take a lot more liberties than they used to when they were smaller farmers, where they have an ability to become very wealthy and use government subsidies to become bigger and bigger and oversupply more and more milk at the hands of people who are not voters, who are not given the rights that other people that are citizens in this country have, and they're completely ignored by constituents, or they're not considered constituents of politicians, and politicians have ignored the fact that we're returning to a feudal society in agriculture because more than 40% of the workers aren't represented by our government.
Owen, thank you so much for bringing in your perspective and for bringing in the perspective of working on a farm. Dee, what are your thoughts there as these farms grow larger and larger?
Well, I think the point that he made about people being not represented by the government, I think that is sort of the entire point of the book you were just discussing, is that people are here, they're doing a needed job, and yet they are being forced to live a shadow life. They are afraid to drive. They're afraid to go to the store these days. They're afraid of being deported. In terms of the fueling the larger and larger farms, I think there are other economic factors going on there which have to do with the economy of the dairy industry. It has been consolidating for a long time. Whether the immigrant availability of immigrant labor is fueling that, it seems that it could be a factor. I don't know that it is the factor. But I think that the point that you've got 40% of the dairy workers or more, probably more, who really have to live this sort of secret life to accomplish a job that we all say that we want them to do and needs to be done.
Very quickly, in the few seconds we have left, what are you watching for here as you look at migrant workers on dairy farms in Wisconsin?
Well, there have been some efforts to legalize, make these, you know, workers legal, and those haven't really gone anywhere. I think it's part of the larger picture. A couple of things. One, there's an overall rural labor shortage, and two, Congress has simply been unwilling to tackle this issue, and I don't see that changing right now.
Well, Dee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Dee Hall is managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, which put out a documentary exploring those tensions over undocumented dairy workers. And earlier we heard from Julie Keller, the author of the new book, Milking in the Shadows, Migrants and Mobility in America's Dairyland. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.